All right, welcome to the Chronic Podcast midweek edition, post New Year's edition. It's 2013. I'm your host, Ralph Marlboro. As always, we're joined by Andrew Juge of the Saints Nation. We thought the Saints were going to get to 8-8, and with Sean Payton signing the extension, everything pointed in that way. But we forgot that the Saints indeed had the worst defense in NFL history, and they can ruin any Sunday afternoon. And they did. They gave up 44 points to Cam Newton and the Panthers and lost 44-38. And Andrew, I think you might have mentioned it in first, so the score wasn't as indicative as how the defense played. No, the defense gave up 530 yards of offense, gave up 44 points, and only one of those touchdowns was really set up because of defense or special teams with the punt return. The rest of them were long-ass drives, converting third downs all over the place. So they're done. They're 7-9. So my question to you is, Andrew, this defense, I think we all agree, it doesn't have to be great. It doesn't have to be top 15. Doesn't have to be top 10. Hell, it doesn't even have to be top 15. You might even argue, I argue, it doesn't even need to be top 20. What's more likely to happen to get the Saints to number 20 in the rankings in 2013 for defense? Is it fire Spagnuolo and tear the whole thing down, start it over, go 3-4, bring in six new starters, just blow it up, or keep Spagnuolo and say we're going to get a couple new starters in free agency, we're going to hope we hit a home run with Sam Montgomery or Barkevious Mingo from LSU, and we're going to hope that gets us to 20. What scenario in your mind is more likely to get the Saints to a ranking on defense that they can win a Super Bowl?
Well, I think we were talking before we started this podcast, and you made a good point that nothing's off the table. And I think it's important that no proposal of a solution at this point is a bad idea, because it's early in the offseason, and we are talking about the team that gave up the most yards in a 16-game season.
7K, baby. 7K.
They're the first team in history to break 7,000 yards yielded. And so from that standpoint, I don't think anything they do in this offseason could possibly make them worse. I mean, like you say, if they fire Spagnuolo, bring in a new coach, install a 3-4, and gut their entire roster defensively and literally bring in, you know, 6 to 7 new starters, young players, inexperienced players, players learning a new scheme, and even then, I'm not sure they yield 7,000 yards. So I don't think there's anything that's off the table. Realistically, I still think they've got some pieces. I still think Bunkley is a good run stuffer. I think Akeem Hicks has starter potential. I like Cam Jordan. Curtis Lawson is a keeper at middle linebacker. Jerry's still out on Hawthorne. He could be okay. We know Jabari Greer is good.
Might be declining.
He's
getting older.
So, yeah, but there's at least, I named at least five guys there that are decent. So there's some stuff that I don't hate about the defense. But I just think realistically, you add maybe one more decent player that's in the quality of a Hawthorne or maybe a Jabari Greer. You have one more decent player, and you hope you hit Yahtzee with that 15th pick. I think that's really, the Saints. And really, I was looking back at the drafts that they've had. They haven't had a superstar draft pick defensively since Mark Fields, and that's borderline.
I would say that's a no, but we,
okay, so Mark Fields went to home. If you say no to Mark Fields, then Joe Johnson was 94. And then before that, they hadn't drafted an elite guy since 89, which was Wayne Martin, and 86, which was Pat Swilling. So we're literally talking over 20 years in some cases.
They're due.
So, I think with this 15th pick, I think we all agree it's got to be defense. And it's got to be a guy they can plug in, and they can make a difference from minute one, kind of like Von Miller did.
Well, here's the thing. And, I worry sometimes, I agree with Dominic D'Angry, who he's been saying, look, if they can fix the pass rush, that it'll help everything. And I agree with that. But how much, Andrew, can, let's say the Saints move up, they would move up, or Sam Montgomery falls to them, or whoever, the guy, I can't think of it. The linebacker from Georgia, I can't think of his name right now, but let's say they pick
Jarvis Jones,
and he's a home run. I'm talking 15 sacks as a rookie. I'm talking rookie of the year is an absolute home run. How much, in your opinion, because you watched the film, how much does that transform the defense?
I think it's significant, and Ralph, you can vouch for me. I'm not permitted to give names, but I talk to an NFL player on a regular basis that plays for a team that is not the New Orleans Saints. But he played against the Saints this year, and I asked him off the record this past weekend why the Saints are so bad defensively, in his opinion. You know, watching, preparing for, you know, when he played them this season, and why and what they need to fix it. And his opinion was that it was easy to game plan against the Saints because they did not have one elite player. They didn't have a difference maker that made you account for where that one person was on the field at all times. You know, Green Bay has that and Clay Matthews Jr. You know, Denver probably has two of them with Von Miller, you know, but Von Miller being one of them. But, you know, you know, Dwight Freeney for the Colts in the past, John Abraham in the past for the Falcons, you know, and Deion Sanders in his prime for the Cowboys, 49ers. So the Saints don't have anyone that resembles that. And I think, you know, if you can name maybe 15 to 20 NFL teams that have that. You know, the Steelers have Cole and Louis. I mean, you go up and down the rosters and you can name one guy that you really have to account for, and he felt like that really didn't exist for the Saints. And I kind of agreed with him. I mean, I think Curtis Lofton is the best player on the defense, and I think he's a good tackler. He's a very solid football player. But I don't think he's a playmaker in the sense that you account for where he is on the field because you risk turnovers or you risk a disastrous play if you don't account for him. You know, I think he's a guy that runs sideline to sideline and tackles well.
Yeah.
So anyway, his point was that the Saints were really missing that one difference maker. And he was clear with me, and you know, I want to be clear with everyone listening. That's not to say that if the Saints land that one person, all of a sudden I'm not saying they're top 10 defense. That doesn't transform everything. But it does make everyone around that one player a little bit better, and it makes things easier for the guys around them. And so when you have that player, I mean, a perfect example, look how the Hornets are playing with Eric Gordon right now. They're looking like they might beat the Atlanta Hawks tonight. We're a good team. Hornets have been horrible all year, and they're about to go 2-0 with Eric Gordon. So, you know, one elite player can make that difference. And like I said, I think that's a more realistic scenario. Now, it's still not realistic. I don't know that if I would bet on it, but I just think if you're asking me what do they have a better shot at, landing a guy that's just going to make a difference on the field or landing six guys that are pretty decent and re-gutting everything, I think the former has a better shot. And look, I think the main takeaway from all of this is we look at the Saints in the entire Sean Payton era. 2009 was the one time they won a Super Bowl. It was also the one time they had what I consider an elite defensive difference maker, and that was Darren Sharper. And yes, they brought him back the following year, but he was a shell of his former self after microfracture surgery. So you look at the only time the Saints have won a Super Bowl, it was the one time they had that player on the field that offenses had to game plan and account for on every play.
Yeah, I mean, and look, you know, I know it gets further and further away, and you're talking about basically a generation of Saints fans now. But look, when I was a teenager, and you had the Dome Patrol, and even before the 2 years they went to the playoffs, when you were talking 19, basically the glory years of it was 90, 91, and 92. I mean, when the Saints had a third down and they were take an example when they had Carolina backed up in the end zone on third and 11. If that was 1991, my eyes as a fan even then would focus not on the ball. I would look at Ricky Jackson because I would think, Andrew, I would think, oh, it's third and long. It's sack time for Ricky Jackson.
Yep.
I don't do that anymore with this defense. I don't focus on one guy. I mean, I'll do it occasionally. Cam Jordan or Akeem Nix just for inches. But on big third downs, I don't go, I'm looking at Cam Jordan to see if they double him, to see if he whips his guy. They don't have that guy. And I think, you know, I think it could help him a lot. But I'm of the opinion, Andrew, that this defense is so wretched with talent that I think even if they hit a home run, I don't think it bumps them up that much if they stay put. They've got to do something different. I'm not opposed to them.
I think the pass rush has been bad, but Ralph, I really think the defensive backfield play has been horrific. And I think the worst two games of the year, defensively, you could argue. I mean, the Giants, you know, obviously the kickoff returns really affected how badly they played. But for me, the worst games were really the first game and the last game.
Yeah.
Which, funny enough, were the two games I attended this year. So, you know, obviously I picked some great ones, and obviously the Saints had great luck with me in the crowd. But so anyway, the Redskins and the Cowboys, and and the Panthers. And no coincidence in my mind, Ralph, that Jabari Greer was missing from both of those games. So I just think the depth at corner is really poor. But I think that's where you point the finger at for me. Yes, the pass rush was poor and that put pressure on them. But week one, Corey White was toasted repeatedly over and over, and he really struggled. And so I think you look at depth and you say, wow, you know, the Saints were really weak at that position. On Sunday, and this was perhaps the most disappointing and worrisome aspect for me, was that you've got Albert Mack starting and you've got Johnny Patrick as your nickel. And despite that, Cam Newton kept going after Patrick Robinson. So you've got your number one corner, and then, you know, Corey White started the year as the number three. So you're missing your number two and your number three, and you've got your number four starting and your number five at nickel. And instead of going after those guys, Cam Newton's going after your number one more frequently. And that to me is a major warning sign, and it points to how much Patrick Robinson has struggled this year. I think as much as, you know, the difference maker at pass rush needs to be the 15th pick, they need to figure out a way to get a starting corner in there, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with the Johnny Patrick, I don't know if he's going to be on an NFL roster next year. I mean, let's just be honest. I think Corey White could be a player. I like the way he came on. But like you said, this the funny thing was Joe Vitt was like, I think the corners came on, and they asked Jabari Greer, and Jabari Greer was like, no, we didn't. We were terrible. So that was an interesting sort of quandary by the Saints. But maybe Joe Vitt was just trying to say something nice in the final press conference of the year. You know, and as you mentioned the secondary, you mentioned it in your grades about Kaduce, how he's not sort of as a last line of defense guy like Malcolm Jenkins. He might not be as athletic. So where Malcolm Jenkins can make a tackle and sort of save a touchdown and be a better last line of defense, but Kaduce has much better ball skills. So sort of what do you want in your safety? I want Kaduce. I want ball skills. That's where I am. So,
well, I think there's two types of players, Ralph. There's two types of players in the NFL. Well, once you get to the NFL, I think you have to have a little bit of screw loose. But prior to that point, I mean, you know, you're talking Pop Warner. You've got two types of football players, and every once in a while, one will come along that has both, And those are the ones that end up being really gifted. But I think you've got your players that are cerebral, that are football players, that play football because they love the catching and the throwing and the X's and O's. And you know, they have a cerebral component, but also just they have fun playing football. And then you've got your nut jobs that just love the violence, that love the contact. And there's a place for both of those types of people in the game, both at the rudimentary level and as you get further down the line to, you know, the professional level. But so when you break it down like that, I think Caduce is more like the previous. You know, he plays football because he's a ball hawk. He's a guy that has good ball skills that can recognize and anticipate well when the ball's in the air and that sort of thing. And I think Malcolm Jenkins is a wood layer. I mean, he's a guy that will see you coming across the middle, and he likes the contact, and he's going to try to knock your head off, and that's intimidating, and he tackles well, and he hits big. But he's not a playmaker. You know, he's not a guy that plays well with the ball in the air. And so, like I said, you have to pick between those two. I think right now, where they are in their development, I think Caduce's ceiling's a little bit higher, because I think, you know, he hasn't had much experience. I think he can get better at taking better angles and becoming a better tackler. I mean, part of that's technique and part of it's experience. But what I definitely saw in those big runs from D'Angelo Williams was he just was slow to react to those runs and took bad angles. And once he got behind him, he wasn't fast enough to catch him. I think that's something where on a couple of those big runs, Malcolm Jenkins takes good angles. And that's the one thing, you know, as much as he struggled this year, that's something he does well as a last line of defense and as a tackler. And I wonder if he had been in that game, if he maybe stopped those runs, 10, 20 yards short of the end zone instead of them being touchdowns. But the difference is, and you saw the flip side, is Caduce was terrific breaking up passes, reading the quarterback, closing quickly on the ball when it was in the air. That stuff Malcolm Jenkins doesn't do well. Getting back to your original point, that's kind of what the coaching staff has to decide. You know, which one in this phase of their development, which player that one has more of a leaning towards good pass defense, one is kind of more of a good run stopper as a free safety. Which style do you prefer more? And I'm with you. I personally think what I see from Issa Abdul-Kadus, I'm far from coming to the point where I feel like he's a player that's arrived, far from it. But I like what I saw more from him this year than Malcolm Jenkins, and so I kind of think I want him as my starter next year.
Yeah, I mean, here's the question: are taking the correct angles on plays, is that more? Is that more a case of you can teach that, or is that more of a case of just sort of instinct, sort of like a running back? They either see the hole or they don't, and you can't really teach it. It's all sort of instinct and just understanding it.
I think you can perfect it. I think you can get better at it. So there's definitely a teaching component that can make him improve. I don't think Issa Abdul-Kadus will ever be as good of a physical, hard-hitting safety as Malcolm Jenkins is now. So I think there's some natural component. Just like I don't think Malcolm Jenkins will ever be the ball hawk that Issa Abdul-Kadus is now. And I'm not saying Issa Abdul-Kadus is Darren Sharper, far from it. But I think, you know, we've seen Malcolm Jenkins back there for 3 years now, and I think we all get it at this point. He's just not a guy that anticipates and reads quarterbacks that well.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be interesting. I don't think they'll move where they'll cut Malcolm Jenkins. I think they'll definitely bring him back and sort of let him fight it out.
Remember, Malcolm Jenkins was a corner to start. And at some point, do you come to the conclusion that he can't cut it as a safety, and you move him back to nickel? Now, I don't think he's the starting corner quality, but I do like him in nickel because that brings him closer to the line of scrimmage where I think he's best. And I still think he can cover in the slot.
The problem with Malcolm Jenkins is the bottom line is the reason why he was there when the Saints were able to pick him is because he didn't run fast enough at the combine to make teams think he could be a starting corner. But like you say, if you put him at nickel, maybe you can get away with it. But I don't necessarily think, Andrew, at safety that it's sort of automatic that the Saints are going to say we need a free safety and we need a guy that can cover the pass and one guy that can cover the run and sort of play Harper and Jenkins like they did in tandem. You know, it wouldn't be beyond me for them to say, hey, you know what, we're going to go with two more pass-oriented safeties, and maybe they're playing Caduce and Bush or Caduce and Jenkins in tandem, and Roman Harper sent on his way in the offseason.
That's not a bad thought. I wouldn't mind them testing that out.
But let's look at also, you know, Cedric Ellis. You watch all these tapes, and sometimes I feel bad for you. What the hell happened to him? He went from being really good and feeling like he played in 09 and he was really coming on to total regression, and just he's a guy and he's going to leave and people are going to be like, eh, whatever. I mean, it was a contract year for him. I mean, if ever you were going to play fantastic, this would have been his year to do so.
Yeah, the crazy thing about him is he hasn't really seen double teams. You know, he hasn't really – it's not like teams have focused on him. But, you know, I definitely blame the demise of his defense as much on him as anything. I mean, the Saints have invested in him heavily.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at the guys that are paid the highest on defense, it's Will Smith, Ellis, and Vilma. You know, those three are the guys that the Saints have invested their money in. And those are arguably the biggest disappointments, those three right there. So, you know, based on that, the Saints have just gotten to a point where the players they've put their money in aren't producing. And then behind them, it's probably Harper and Greer. And Greer is the only one who I would say has even had a marginal season of those five. You know, now they need to cut the dead weight. I mean, that's a lot of dead weight, you know, in terms of money that they're paying to those guys, and they need to replace them with, look, Akeem Hicks is cheap labor, and he's, to me, performing better than Ellis is right now. I have no idea. I have no idea what happened to Ellis. He used to beat guys off the ball. He used to line up one-on-one and provide immense amounts of pressure on the interior, and I don't know if he just has lost a step or if he's injured or he's just lost his passion, but he is not playing anywhere close to what he was like his first 3 years. And sometimes that happens. I mean, look at John Stinchcomb. He went from a Pro Bowler to retired in about a New York minute. So it happens. You know, you never know when guys, the light just comes off. And I kind of feel like that's the case for Ellis. I mean, I'm sure he'll end up playing for someone next year, but I definitely think he's past his prime.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about him is, and you know, people like to say on the draft, they rate a guy, oh, yeah, that guy's a bust. But I hesitate to call Ellis that, but to me, Andrew, when you move up from 11 to number 7 in the draft, and that was before the rookie wage scale, so they paid him a ton of money because he was a 7th pick. When you pick a defensive tackle, number 7, you're expecting him to be, if not a first team all pro, a perennial Pro Bowler, you're expecting him 5 years later to say, who's the best guy on your defense? It's Cedric Ellis. And to me, he's been closer to a bust than a success.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to call him a bust just because his first 3 years really were that good. But it's strange. You really felt like he was on the verge, on the cusp of really becoming a perennial Pro Bowler after that third year. You're like, man, he's been good. He's only getting better. And, you know, the whole Rodgers, Abreu Franklin experiment did something weird to him. I really felt like he was getting less snaps. And it was strange. I just felt like when those guys were
playing over him, and he was just, you know, more of a rotation than a full-time starter. I just don't feel like he's a guy that needs to play more and get in the rhythm. But, you know, and Spagnuolo's defense was definitely situational as well, like Greg Williams. But the situational playing just didn't work for him.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, you got to be a pro and you got to shake it off. I mean, this was a huge year for him, Andrew. If he would have gone out and got six sacks and you know, every week you'd have been giving him a B. I mean, you're not the only person watching tape, obviously. NFL personnel departments are doing it too. I mean, he could have made himself $50 million. And got $20 million guaranteed.
That's the unfair thing of expectations, Ralph. I mean, if you look at a guy like Junior Gallette, you would say that, okay, he's had maybe about a similar year to Cedric Ellis. You know, he's maybe had a slightly better year overall this season. But we all love Junior Gallette because he was undrafted and the expectations are low and he doesn't get paid much. So we want to keep him around. But the flip side is with Ellis, he makes a ton of money. He was the 7th overall pick. And so we're all clamoring for him to have a Pro Bowl season. Well, instead he turns in a season that's just mediocre. You know, it's kind of fine. It's like what Junior Gallette gave us. But the difference is he's getting paid a lot more and he was drafted a lot higher. So I think he's a little bit of a victim of his own success and the expectations. I mean, you know, So I think that's kind of in some ways unfair to him maybe, but the bottom line is he shouldn't be making what he's making right now. You know, he hasn't lived up to the pay that he's getting, and for that reason, you know, and I really think he's the type of guy, you know, he should be making $1 million, $2 million a year. And if we were giving him that, I'd be fine with him being a situational player. But it's just, you know, we're obviously Spencer's paying him too much.
Do you think he'll be back with the Saints at a significant discount, or do they move on?
I can't imagine Cedric Ellis. I can't imagine him playing it less. I think he views himself as a guy that I know for a fact that in the Greg Williams defense, he felt like his strengths weren't being utilized. And he felt like he was a victim of a scheme that didn't work to his strengths. So I have no idea how he feels about Spagnuolo or how things went this year. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like he's going to be one of those players that goes on the market, kind of like Lofton and some of those guys last year where they think they're going to get a huge payday. And once the market settles, maybe he realizes, oh, well, I'd rather come back to the Saints for $1.5 million a year for 2 years. You know, let's say a 2-year, $3.5 million deal. I'd rather do that than sign a 1-year, $2 million deal with the Patriots. So I could see him maybe doing that, but you know, I just think he's going to expect to go out there and make some silly money. And there's some pretty stupid teams out there. I wouldn't be shocked if a bad team threw some good money at him. He is considered a high character player, and he's considered a serious guy. And I know he's got a lot of respect around the league. He's a good dude. So you know, from that standpoint, he may attract some offers. I mean, Fujita certainly got way more than he was worth.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Fujita got the we want a high character, maybe average to above average player who has the quote unquote championship experience and know-how and was a captain on a Super Bowl team. I mean, he got paid for that by Mangini, but this is a good segue, Andrew, because we're, you know, the Saints do have some free agents. And me and you have sort of been arguing on the podcast before and off air and all that about the Saints' biggest one, Jermon Bushrod. Bushrod, I waffle back and forth, me and you. You know, I've changed my mind. I can't figure out if he's going to get big money. Part of me thinks no, because in 2009 he was coming off the Saints had won the Super Bowl and he was the tackle, and you know, teams are desperate for left tackles, and he signed a 2-year deal with the Saints. So if they didn't want him then, he hasn't really improved that much from then. But then that was the lockout year, so maybe teams weren't it was a weird year, so teams didn't have as much time to evaluate or whatever. But I don't know. You could lay out any scenario for Bushrod, Andrew. You could say Jacksonville gives him 5 years, $50 million. It's $18 million guaranteed. Now I'd go okay. Or you could say the Saints re-sign him for 3 years at $21 million, and it's $8 million guaranteed. I have no idea what kind of contract he's going to get.
Well, I think what will end up happening, I do think the Saints want him back, Ralph, because they can't spend their 15th pick on a left tackle. And, you know, obviously they're going to have to draft. It'd be nice to have that second-round pick back because, you know, they're probably going to need to use that on a left tackle if Bushrod leaves. But I think the situation will be a lot like Nick's. You know, I think it'll be less money than Nick's, obviously, a lot less money. But I think the Saints are prepared to let him test the market, much like they're prepared to let Knicks do so. And they're going to say, here's what we're willing to offer you. Here is what, you know, with Loomis will hit the books. He will clean up as much of the cap as he can in order to offer him a fair deal. And he'll say, this is what I'm willing to give you. If you want it, great. If you don't, we'll offer this money to the next best tackle. In free agency. I believe that's what the Saints will do. And so I think based on that, you know, I think Bushrod wants to come back. I think he'll take it. And unless he gets a knock your socks off offer like the Bucks did with Knicks, then I think he's coming back at whatever the Saints offer him. But I don't think he's done anything in the last 2 years to change anyone's opinion of him in the NFL. In fact, he's gotten 2 years older. So I would be surprised if he got a huge offer, like 5 years, $50 million. But if he does, the Saints are definitely not going to match it, and they'll be fine letting him go because there's just no way they're going to pay him that kind of money.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, everybody knew Knicks was going to get paid. And yeah, the Saints basically offered him the Ben Grubbs deal, which was a really nice deal. I mean, they moved fast, and we were like, damn, they paid Grubbs a lot of money. They were serious about it. They don't fool around at guard. You know, it's an interesting thing with him is I don't see teams giving him big money because, you know, in free agency, once it comes around, we'll see people's columns. But even last year, during the season, people were like, Carl Nix is going to be one of the top. I mean, when everybody listed their top 10 free agents, I mean, Carl Nix was in the top five. And, you know, if it wouldn't have been Tampa giving him the money, it would have been somebody else. So we'll see it. But like you said, it only takes one stupid team, or not necessarily – maybe stupid's the wrong word, Andrew, but
desperate.
Desperate.
Yeah.
So if I had to say, Andrew, let's put a $5 bet on it, Bushrod with the Saints or not in 2013?
I think he's coming back. I'll say $5 he comes back. I think what he said in the media, you know, obviously, like Knicks, I just, if we're talking about $15 million, he's going to leave. I mean, he's not stupid, you know, and I think if it's a no-brainer financially, you know, that someone's just offering him way more money, then he'll leave. But if it's close, you know, if we're $1 to $2 million off, I think he gets the Saints a hometown discount. And based on what he said in the media this week, it sounds to me like, I know he just had a baby. He settled in New Orleans. I have every reason to believe he wants to come back. And I don't think the Saints want to get in a position where they're trying to fill left tackle. I think the Saints want to maintain offensively. You know, I really think this offseason is about fixing the defense. And so, you know, you don't want to get to a point where you're left with a whole left tackle. So I think he comes back.
Well, let's hope so. So Sean Payton's back. He signed the contract extension. The only, you know, I don't have many sources left with the Saints, but the one for the dude was like, look, he's not leaving. Nobody in the building is thinking he's leaving, and that's the way it went. He's back. So, Andrew, if they don't let him come back before the Super Bowl, which I don't think they will, what happens if the Saints, if somebody says, you know, they're going to have, what, 8 new coaches? What if they say, hey, Andy Reid, if he gets the job in Arizona, what if he says to Spagnuolo, hey, Steve, come to Arizona, you know? And Steve Spagnuolo says, hey, I want to go to Arizona. What the hell do the Saints do? And basically, that means Goodell's suspension will kind of fuck the Saints for 2 years because they'll have positions to fill, and they won't have a coach in the building to do it. So what do you think the Saints would do? Will they just lock down? Do they lock down the coaches and say you can't leave because they can't have contact with Sean Payton to say, hey, Spagnuolo wants to go. Do you want him to go and we'll just replace him? Do you want the special teams guy wants to go? Do you want to fire him? And are you thinking of firing him so he can go get another job and we can fill it? You know, it could really fuck the Saints over kind of for 2 years. What do you think – how do you think the offseason is going to play out as far as the Saints coaching staff?
I'm concerned about it, you know, and I think there was at least a nugget that was thrown out there that Goodell would be open to Sean Payton coming back after the season ended, but before the Super Bowl was over. So if he were to come back at some point in the playoffs, that would be monumental. And I really do agree, and, you know, the scenarios you – laid out make it important for Sean Payton to be back before the end of the Super Bowl. Now, is it the end of the world? You know, probably not, but you know, my nightmare scenario is Pete Carmichael gets a job and goes elsewhere. I don't think that's going to happen, but or you know, Spagnuolo too, but you know, if, especially if Pete Carmichael leaves. I mean, I think we've seen now with Williams and Spagnuolo, the Saints model is, offense is Sean's. He will pay you a lot of money. Tom Benson has proved that. I will pay a lot of money for a high-end, respected coach to come in and run the defense. And he can have the keys to the car. Now, granted, after what happened to Greg Williams, they're probably keeping a closer eye on that stuff. But he can have the keys to the car on defense. You run your thing. You do your thing. I won't bother you. I'm just going to focus on offense. I'll give you the number one offense in the league. You just give me something decent. So I think that's the model, for the Saints. And, so I'm less concerned about that because if Spagnuolo leaves, I feel like they could hire Lovie Smith or they, you know, maybe Lovie Smith gets the head coaching job, but they could get a high guy like that, a high profile defensive coach. I'm more worried about, Carmichael getting fired and then Sean Payton having Carmichael getting another job somewhere. Sean Payton having a list of 3-4 guys he likes. He can't contact them. The Saints, presumably, he can't have contact with Payton. These guys all end up getting hired somewhere else. And you've got 5-6 solid coaches that would have killed to coach with Sean Payton. And instead, he ends up hiring some guy that's 6 down on his list. So that would be a disaster. You know, and I mean, it could affect things for 2013. It absolutely could. So, you know, I really am a firm believer that when a team has success, you know, everything has to line up perfectly. You know, and everything from the coaches to the equipment managers to the, you know, they all play a part, you know, and if something's dysfunctional, you know, you hope that you've got enough solid pieces in place around it to absorb that dysfunctionality. But you know, in some ways, it almost has to work perfectly in unison for a team to win a Super Bowl. You know, you have to get lucky. So, certainly, I think to start the season with something like that would put the Saints behind the eight ball for minute one. So, look, I have no idea how it's going to play out, but your point is a good one, and it makes me nervous. And I think as Saints fans, we got to hope that Payton gets reinstated sooner.
Yeah, because I mean, and it's unfair to Payton, and it's unfair to the assistants too, because they're under contract. And you know, Sean Payton always has a sort of philosophy: hey, I will let you leave if you are moving up the chain. You know, if you're going to go from a position coach to a coordinator or a coordinator where you can call your own plays, I'm not going to hold you back. But, you know, you also, you'd feel bad for the Saints assistant coaches if Loomis is like, look, Sean Payton's on suspension. I know they want to talk to you, but tough shit, you can't. You know, then you got a pissed off employee because he may say, well, I'm a linebacker coach or I'm a wide receiver coach. I want to be, you know, a coordinator, whatever. Like you say, you get pissed off employees, which you got to have everything line up to win a Super Bowl. So it's a thing that to me, I didn't really think about it until I read. I apologize. I forget who it was, like NOLA.com or somewhere. You know, it was a big issue. And also specifically about Carmichael, Andrew, I think that after Sean Payton broke his leg in 2011, he let Carmichael call the plays, and Sean Payton never took it back over. And I think Sean Payton even admitted it. It was a big factor in the success because Sean Payton, he relinquished the play calling duty, and it gave him an opportunity to see the game a different way and not be focused so much on calling plays and more of an overall picture. And I think if Carmichael leaves, Sean Payton is taking back the play calling duties because there's not going to be anybody that he's going to bring in from outside or elevate that he has as much trust as Carmichael. And I don't necessarily think, not that it's a bad thing that Sean Payton's called plays because look, they won a Super Bowl with him doing it, but you know, it was really something special in 2011. So that's an issue specific to Carmichael. If he leaves, Sean Payton's going to be taking more of a burden on the offense.
That's a good point. And, you know, you think about it in terms of Payton, he probably wants to have a bigger picture view of the Saints after Bounty Gate. You know, I think he let a lot fly and he let a lot happen under his watch, under his direction, without paying much attention. And I don't think that's going to happen the second. That's what got him suspended. And I don't think that's going to happen the second time around. I think he wants to have more jurisdiction and more of a watchful eye on everything going on with this football team. So I really think from that standpoint, you know, that's a good point. And he wants and would want Carmichael back. And I agree that if he's not back, then Sean Payton's calling the plays, period. But, you know, I think as Saints fans, we can hope for the best. I mean, you said it's not really fair to the assistant coaches. But I think we've also seen that Roger Goodell doesn't really have a regard for what's there. And he's had his axe to grind with the Saints.
Well,
and so I don't think we can count on what's fair coming to fruition, you know. So I think we just got to hope for the best. But, you know, if Spagnuolo leaves, if Carmichael leaves, for me, that's a major concern, especially with the Saints not having an opportunity to hire anyone with Sean Payton out, or they hire someone while Sean Payton's still out that Sean Payton may not be happy with.
I think that in that scenario, Andrew, I wouldn't see him doing that. I would just think that they would either petition the commissioner and be like, "Come on, dude," or they'd wait for Payton to get back. I can't see them hiring. I mean, I can't see them.
I mean, who knows? That's the thing about all this. It's unprecedented.
Yeah,
I mean, we have no idea how this is going to play out because this has literally never happened. It's unheard of.
Well, and also, as a Saints fan, the guy to keep an eye on as a hire that could really affect the Saints coaching staff is Doug Marrone from Syracuse. He's getting interviews with, I think, Buffalo and Cleveland, and he was a Saints offensive line coach and did a really, really good job. He was pre-Cromer, and he went to Syracuse after the 08 year. Now, Andrew, it's beyond me how Doug Marrone is getting interviews for an NFL job after getting Syracuse to 6-6 in the Pinstripe Bowl. I don't know why that's so impressive, but I guess there's a reason why Buffalo and Cleveland have stunk for the better part of a decade.
well, I think he gets hired for offensive coordinator if Carmichael left.
Exactly. And because he is a direct descendant of the Peyton tree. He's going to come looking for guys. He'll say, hey, Aaron, come run my offense. Hey, so-and-so, come, you know, you're a position coach. Come run my defense. I think that's a distinct possibility. So he's a guy, as a Saints fan, if he gets hired, then I think there's definitely a potential for shuffles on the Saints staff.
I do think Carmichael's back, though. I don't want to freak everyone out too bad.
No.
I mean, I think Pete Carmichael's coming back, if I had to guess.
Okay. So let's end this podcast. The 2012 season, besides this, you know, obviously Bounty Gate, you're going to remember it. You're going to be like, Sean Payton got suspended. But what else are you going to remember? What else is going to stick out in your mind? For me, the one thing that's going to stick out is Vilma's interception against Carolina. Even though they lost, it was a great moment and sort of a FU to Roger Goodell, because, you know, for all intents and purposes, Vilma shouldn't have been playing. So I'll remember that. And I'll also remember, to me, Andrew, I'll remember the first interception against San Francisco. Because to me, I've said it probably a couple times already in previous episodes, that was the Saints' high point of 2012. They were 5-5. The Dome was rocking. They had just intercepted. They were going in for another score to get to 6-5 maybe and beat the team that everybody thought at the time was the best team in the NFC. Drew Brees threw the pick six. It went downhill and never really recovered from it. Those are sort of the two on-field moments that will stick with me about this year.
Yeah, I mean, are you saying mostly from a positive standpoint?
No, negative. I mean, you know, the Vilma was positive, and the interception against San Francisco of Drew Brees, the pick six, obviously was not positive. It was really negative.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've got two moments for you that are positive and negative. So the positive moment for me that I'll take from the season is, you know, even though the Saints ended 7-9 and, you know, there were obviously a lot of reasons for that demise. The positive moment for me of the year was handing Atlanta their first loss, you know, when they were winning every which way and just finding ways to win. And, despite the fact that the Saints were somewhat outplayed, they found a way to win. They basically pulled an Atlanta on Atlanta in the Superdome, and the Saints were down, and the Falcons were undefeated and playing great. And for them to end their perfect season against a bitter rival, and in the process kind of vault themselves back in the discussion for the playoffs was a really special moment. So for me, beating Atlanta was the on-field moment of the season. With honorable mention of the Vilma pick six, which it's really too bad the Saints lost that game, because if they won, I think that play becomes even more special. But it's mired somewhat by the worst defense in the NFL having the worst performance of their season on that Sunday. But the negative for me also is against Atlanta, and it was losing to them in Atlanta, more specifically Breeze's 5 interceptions. So that's kind of the
and
moment.
And the touchdown record.
Out to me. Yeah, losing the touchdown record and, well, not losing it, but just ending the record where it stands now and throwing 5 picks against our bitter rivals. And I mean, it was just an utter embarrassment and kind of the shocking moment of the season where it's just like, how did this happen? Why, you know, what happened to Drew Brees for him to have the worst game of his professional career? Those two moments for me on field are what I take away.
Yeah, and I mean, it just, as I said in my column, I'm glad the 2000 Saints season is over, and we will not remember you fondly. You know, it's just it's one of those seasons where, because of everything, they're just. I personally, I don't know how you feel, the excitement and the, oh my God, it's August and this is awesome, it's football, like, the last, you know, ever since Drew Brees and Sean Payton have gotten here, every year it's been like, fuck yeah, it's August, it's football, it's Saints, we're thinking, you know, we're maybe we won't win the Super Bowl, but we're going to be in it. We're going to be playoff contention. It's going to be fun, and it's going to be awesome. This year, I would say my excitement level, Andrew, was maybe half of what it's been the previous six.
Yeah, no, and I mean, so much of that has to do with not having your coach, and I mean, it's kind of a circus comedy, you know. It's just like, Vitt's out, and he's our head coach, so now it's Cromer, okay. I mean, we were literally joking that Rita would get a game in as head coach in our podcast at the beginning of the season, so.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, but, it's good to have it in the rearview mirror. It was exhausting, I think, for us as bloggers.
That's a good word.
And as fans. I mean, it was an exhausting season, just starting 0-4 and basically feeling like the season was dead to rights before it even started, getting a little false optimism with them getting the 5-5, and then just getting really just dump trucked by some teams down the stretch, especially Denver and the Giants and having some really horrible second halves against San Fran and Atlanta that kind of kissed the season goodbye, and then a little mini run there at the end to make it exciting again. But ultimately, it was exhausting. And, you throw Brees' contract situation in the mix in the off season on top of that. And look, whatever happens this off season, I just feel like it's going to be nice to have less to write about as a blogger. And it's going to be nice to be able to take a deep breath and just, enjoy less being in the news less.
It's going to be all draft all the time for anybody.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that.
And I'm okay with that. That's exactly right. It's going to be all draft all the time, and you're going to be fine with it, and you're going to love it. So, Andrew, it's the end of the season, so the podcast will be less frequent, but you're going to be joining us, and we're going to be doing draft shit out the wazoo. Me and Andrew met up. We were talking about our plans. We got some cool stuff going. Go to Saints Nation. Get your fix. Because you know what? It seems like it's a long way off, but you know what? It'll be March before you know it, and April, and it'll be draft time. And my friend, we'll be breaking down defensive ends from Louisiana Tech, and it'll be glorious.
Oh, well, my blog goes all season long.
Yeah.
The Saints may only be from – August to this year, December, really, but usually August to February is our window. But my blog runs, year round. So
exactly.
We're going to keep talking Saints. We're going to keep defining stuff to discuss. Even if it's raising my 2-year-old, we're talking about Ralph's drinking problem.
It is a serious problem.
We'll think of some things to bring up. So, no doubt, man. And this is our passion. It's what we love. And so
yep.
It's nice that the season's over, but, I'm already starting to think about next year and that 15th pick and what they're going to do with the offseason. So there's reason for optimism. They still have Drew Brees and Sean Payton coming back.
Exactly. So happy new year, my friend. And to all the people out there, be well and be safe. And thank God 2012 is over.
Amen. Happy new year. Thanks for having me.